2 Kings 2 is a very unusual chapter. I'm going to read it in just a moment. But before I read it, I want to present a case that the whole chapter ought to be read as a unit, which is why we're going to deal with the whole chapter together. And I'll just give you two reasons why I believe this. Reason number one is there is a narrative structure, like kind of like road signs through the chapter that revolve around geography of all things. So oftentimes when you read through the Bible, there are people and places and, you know, all these kind of details. 2 Kings 2 is very heavy in that. And so if you were to go through it, it starts in Gilgal, or just outside of Gilgal in verse 1. By verse, where are we? By verse 2, they've gone to Bethel. By verse 4, it's to Jericho. By verse 6, they've crossed the Jordan. And then if you read through the story, you'll see then it continues to unfold in reverse order. By verse 13, crossing the Jordan again. By verse 15, back to Jericho. By verse 23, thereabouts, they're back to Bethel. And then finally, back eventually to Samaria. So it's this interesting progression where it's like they're on a journey, kind of going somewhere, and then they get there and turn around and go back. And so the whole chapter tells the story of this journey, even though there are three or four seemingly unrelated stories through it that are probably pretty peculiar. In fact, I said to the earlier service, I'm pretty sure if I just went down onto Main Street, Vernon, and said, hey, could I read you a story, and read 2 Kings 2, there'd be a lot of people going, the Bible has some really strange stories in it. It's like, yes, but there is a spectacular truth that God is communicating through these stories when you keep them together. So that would be number one, the narrative structure. Number two is if you were to read from 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 17 and 18, that reads like this. So he died. This is the king we were talking about last week, Ahaziah. So he died according to the word of the Lord that Elijah had spoken. Jehoram became king in his place in the second year of Jehoram, the son of Josaphat, king of Judah, because Ahaziah had no son. Now the rest of the acts of Ahaziah that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? Skip chapter 2 for a second. Pretend it's not there and jump to chapter 3, verse 1. In the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, Jehoram, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel. In other words, you could literally lift chapter 2 right out of scripture, pretend it's not there, and seemingly not miss a beat in the story. Now, we're not going to do that because all of God's word is inspired. It's intended to be there. And I think part of the reason it's there is essentially to say, you know what? You might think there are great things going on in castles among kings and kingdoms, and that the most important thing in the world going on is the succession of kings and who will be king. But God is saying right in the middle of it, you'd be missing really the most important thing of all, which is what is God doing in the middle of all that? So without building any more of a case for it, you're going to have to, I guess, just take my word for it. Chapter 2 is meant to be read as one complete unit. So let's give it a shot. Verse 1. Now, when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven by a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. So it's kind of a spoiler alert beginning to the story, isn't it? There's not like a buildup, and then we find out later that he's taken up in a whirlwind. It's almost like God is saying, hey, I'm going to get this big idea out of the way first. We're going to talk about Elijah being taken away. And then now that we've dealt with that, it's almost like God is saying, now I can make sure that you can pay attention to the rest of the details because you know the big piece. Now pay attention to the rest of what's going to happen. Verse 2, then Elijah said to Elisha, please stay here for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel. But Elisha said, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. So they went down to Bethel. And the sons of the prophets who were in Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, do you know that today the Lord will take your master away from you, from over you, sorry? And he said, yes, I know it. Keep quiet. By the way, the sons of the prophets are not bad prophets, just in case you're trying to figure out who are these guys. These are true prophets of the Lord that God had. You remember he had 7,000 who were still faithful to him. These are part of the 7,000. Verse 4, Elijah said to him, Elisha, please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho. But he said, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. So they came to Jericho, and the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho drew near to Elisha and said, do you know that today the Lord will take away your master from you? And he said, yes, I know. Keep quiet. Isn't it awesome that God has his prophets in the two most wicked places in all of Israel? Like in ancient times, Bethel and Jericho are like the center of everything that is unrighteous and opposed to God. It's sort of like, you know, forgive me if you like going to Vegas, but you know, in our mind's eye, it's like, oh, Vegas is Sin City. That's like the center of bad things, right? Happen there. And if you were to go back to ancient Israel and kind of go pick a spot on a map where bad things happen, it's like, well, they happen either at Bethel or Jericho. That's where bad things happen. And God has his prophets right in the middle of the darkest of dark, because God is, he's just never afraid of the dark, is he? He's at work right there. Verse 6, then Elijah said to him, please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to the Jordan. By the way, this is like 25 miles one way. It's a long, can you imagine, it's your last day on earth. You know it. He knows it's his last day on earth. What would you want to do with your last day? It's like, I know what I'll do. I'll go for a 25-mile walk through the desert. What a great idea, right? But God is directing him. Now he's coming to the Jordan, and he said, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, this is the third time now, I will not leave you. So the two of them went on. Verse 7, 50 men of the sons of prophets also went and stood at some distance from them as they were both standing on the Jordan. Then Elijah took his cloak, rolled it up, and struck the water. The water was parted to the one side and to the other, till the two of them could go over it on dry ground. This is like the last miracle of Elijah. It's a very personal miracle, right? It's like the river is parted so he can cross on dry ground. Bear in mind that it very much has the appearance of another miracle. When Moses is leading the children of Israel out of Egypt and he parts the sea so they can go across on dry ground. Interesting that we're going to pick that up a little bit later. When they had crossed, verse 9, Elijah said to Elisha, ask what I shall do for you before I'm taken from you. And Elisha said, please let there be a double portion of your spirit on me. And he said, you've asked a hard thing. Yet, if you see me as I'm being taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if you do not see me, it shall not be so. And as they still went on and talked, behold, chariots of fire and horses of fire separated the two of them. I would have loved to hear that conversation. Just, you know, one of those Bible moments. I'm like, I wonder what Elijah and Elisha talked about that day. 25 miles worth walking along and just talking together. And in the middle of it, suddenly, God sends a chariot of fire and horses of fire to separate them. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Lots of us have a picture of this story. At least I did. Probably was fueled by childhood flannel graphs of Elijah in a fiery chariot, right? It's like Elijah goes up to heaven in a fiery chariot, not a whirlwind, but literally the fiery chariot comes along and separates Elijah from Elisha almost. For those of you who are really wanting to study this more, go back and read Leviticus 1, because it almost has the appearance of God carrying out the instructions of a sacrifice in this. It's a very, very peculiar picture going on here. He separates them, and then a violent gust of wind, that's what a whirlwind is, a violent gust of wind comes, and whew, Elijah's taken, gone. Not dead, taken. Verse 12, and Elisha saw it, and he cried, my father, my father. Remember, he's asked for a double portion of his spirit. That's what the oldest son would receive for an inheritance, a double portion. That's actually a great law. It's a shame that we no longer have that one in place, speaking as an oldest son. So he's asked for this. So he's kind of giving us a picture of his relationship, his view of his relationship to Elijah. He views him like a father. Now he says it, my father, my father. That part makes sense. It's the next statement, the next title or description he gives that is almost hard to know what it means. Because he's speaking of Elijah, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. It's his description of Elijah. Elijah, you are like the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. Elijah, you are like all of the strength and the might of an army. You're like a one-man army. And as long as you were here, we were okay, because you were the one that stood against the king, and you were the ones who stood against the prophets of Baal, and you were the one who stood with insurmountable courage and conviction. My father, my father, you were like the chariots and horsemen of Israel. And now he's gone. And then he took the cloak of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water, saying, where is the Lord, the God of Elijah? And when he had struck the water was parted to the one side and to the other, and Elisha went over. Now, when the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho saw him opposite them, they said, the spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha. In other words, they watched the first crossing of the Jordan. They stayed there and now watch Elisha come back doing the same miracle and conclude rightly, the spirit of God now rests on Elisha because he has just duplicated the miracle we watched Elijah just do shortly before this. And they came to meet him and bowed to the ground before him. They recognized God is, his spirit is on this man. And they said to him, behold now, there were with your servants 50 strong men. Please let them go and seek your master. And maybe that the spirit of the Lord caught him up, cast him on some mountain or into some valley. And he said, you shall not send. But when they urged him till he was ashamed, I don't know what they said to him. It's like, but don't you love Elijah? Like, surely if you loved him, you would want to find him. Whatever they did, they kept at him until he finally let them go. And he said, send. And they sent, therefore, 50 men. And for 3 days they sought him, but they did not find him. And they came back to him while he was staying at Jericho. And he said to them, I don't know where the emphasis is on this. It's a very interesting statement. Did I not say to you, do not go? Because you could read that in lots of different tones, right? You could read that as like an angry thing. You could read that as a sad sort of thing. You could read it as told you so. Because you see what's going on. Here's these sons of the prophets. They're like, they recognize the spirit of God on Elisha. But all they can think about is we need to find Elijah again. He is the prophet of God. He's the one who led us. And he was not to be found. Verse 19. Now the men of the city, which city? Jericho, because that's where they were staying in the previous verse, said to Elisha, behold, the situation of the city is pleasant. It's a good place to live, in other words, as my Lord sees, but the water is bad and the land is unfruitful. And he said, bring me a new bowl and put salt in it. So they brought it to him. Then he went to the spring of water, threw salt in it and said, thus says the Lord, I have healed this water. From now on, neither death nor miscarriage shall come from. In other words, it seems like the situation in Jericho, beautiful place, beautiful valley, but the water is causing death among livestock, among their children. And Elisha, through the powerful working of God, restores that. Verse 22, so the water has been healed to this day, according to the word that Elijah spoke. One more story. I guarantee most of us have never heard a sermon on this last story. Although it's really hard to read without a bit of a smile. So I apologize. It's a tragic story. It's really... Anyway, don't look at me, because it'll... Then he went up from there to Bethel. And while he was going up on the way, some small boys came out of the city and jeered at him and said, go up, you bald head, go up, you bald head. And I know from the balcony, I know what it looks like down here, but it's, when I see it in the mirror, there's a lot of hair up here. That's why I love this story. It's like, you better be careful if you don't tease those of us losing our hair, because look what happens next. He turned around, and when he saw them, he cursed them in the name of the Lord. Two she-bears came out of the woods, tore 42 of the boys. From there, he went on to Mount Carmel, and from there, he returned to Samaria. Just like this most casual of stories. It's like, he taunted him for his baldness. He called the curse from God. The bears killed 42 boys, and on he went on his way. Anyone ever heard a sermon on that one? All right. What I want to do is I want to make four observations of this whole scene. And then I want to try to get us to the main point and do it a lot faster than I did in the first service. That's my goal. So, point number one, this whole scene, like I mentioned already, is built around geography. There's not a lot of passages or scriptures in the Bible that really are built around a pure geographical narrative. This would be one. And I think there's a reason for that. If you were to picture these locations, this 25-mile journey that then is reversed and come back. So Elijah and Elisha go, and then Elijah's gone, and Elisha comes back. And if you were to pull out a map, you would have before your eyes a replay of the early chapters of Joshua. In fact, there's multiple places called Gilgal, and this is kind of where it's a little bit interesting, because when Israel comes across the River Jordan first, the first place they come is a place called Gilgal, before they get to Jericho and then go to Bethel, which is another name for Ai, or right in that same area. So the problem is there is another place called Gilgal after Bethel, if you go read through the story, Mount Gerizim, Mount Ebal. So you can go look through a map. What it appears to be happening would be something like this, that Elijah starts out in Gilgal, then he travels to Bethel or Ai, which if you know, that's like the second city that Israel attacks when they cross the promised land. Then he travels to Jericho, which is the first city that God leads them to. Then he gets to the Jordan River and crosses it, which if you read through Joshua is the exact opposite of how Israel enters the land. It's almost like Elijah is acting out for us the fact that Israel has become Egypt. And there's a new exodus that's needed. And God is going to deliver his people. And if that's right, then what happens next is equally stunning, that Elisha then turns around and reenacts a new entry into the promised land. In other words, God is saying, I'm going to once again bring my people into this land and establish it for them, and I will lead them in towards faithfulness. And so in this, just this little geographic sequence, you have a message of God saying, the land has fallen into sin and there's consequences. But I'm not done with the land. I'm going to come back and I'm going to see it restored again. All that through this little geographical sort of picture that's being painted. The second thing that I think is interesting and worth paying attention to is the unusual and ironic nature of the taking away of Elijah. I mean, it could have just been the scene when Moses is taken up onto the mountain and dies. It's very, very scant on details. They don't know where it happens. There's not much really description at all. It could have just been like that, right? It could have just been a story where God just came and took him away, and that was the end of the story. But you get very vivid detail of what takes place with chariots coming and horses coming and a whirlwind coming and Elijah's response to this whole thing. And I think there's a deliberate reason for it, and I think it has to do with God showing himself as powerful over all the other gods. It's a spectacular scene. So we've been tracking through Elijah's story. Most of his life has been responding to the false worship of a god, a false god, a fake god, a not real god by the name of Baal. And Baal is the weather god, god of storms. If you see depictions of him, like because there's actual idols, you can go to museums and see the idols that people had made of him. You'll also see what they call reliefs. So in other words, they take a flat surface and etch into it a picture. So it's a relief. It's drawing what they pictured Baal to look like. He's usually depicted as holding a thunderbolt. He's usually depicted on riding on a chariot. Sometimes it's of wind. Sometimes it's of fire. In other words, what's going on in this scene seems eerily like God is saying, Baal is no God at all. There is a God who is over the weather, over the storms, over the wind, over lightning, over all of it. But it's not Baal, it's me. And then, just to make things even more interesting, Baal has a competitor. I think we even talked about him maybe many weeks ago. And this competitor god actually is the god over the seas and the ocean and chaos and all these kind of things. So there's this rivalry between these two gods. And it seems like in this scene, as God brings Elijah over the Jordan on dry land and takes Elisha back over this river on dry land, it's almost like God is saying, not only am I the god who is over weather and all these things, and Baal is no god, but Baal's competitor is no god either. Because when I want to stop the waters of a river, it's that easy. I mean, just go try this. Go to the Shushuap, you know, go up to the river, right outside of Enderby. You see if you can stop it. You don't have to do it for long. You don't even have to get it totally dry. We'll make it a little easier on you. All you need to do is just stop the water for 5 seconds. Could still be mud, right? You realize, like, no one's going to drive up there and attempt it because we can't do that. But God can. And his prophets cross on dry land, and in essence, he is saying, I'm the God over the weather and the lightning and the storms and the wind and the rivers and the seas and the oceans. I love how Revelation speaks of the throne room of God, because in the New Testament, often sin and chaos is associated with waves and storms of the sea. It's why the disciples are so terrified every time they go out in a boat, right? And the waves come up, they're afraid because there's this association with evil is under there, demonic is under there. And this description in Revelation chapter 4 is before the throne of God, the sea is like glass. God is not, he's not resisted. He is infinitely powerful. And at the end of Revelation, when it says the sea is no more, just for those of you who love the sea and the sound of a river, I don't think it's God saying there's not going to be a lake in heaven or an ocean. If he wants there to be one, there could be. What he's saying is everything associated, all the associations of evil and sin and brokenness, gone. It's gone. And so God is showing in this story that he is infinitely powerful than any of these other so-called lesser, small g gods. Third thing is the complex relationship between Elijah and Elisha. And I won't get you very far on this one because I actually don't totally know how to unpack it, to be completely honest. It showed up right at the start when God had said to Elijah, go and anoint Elisha. And if you read the story way back there in 1 Kings, it seems like a very half-hearted anointing. He doesn't really, he never actually anoints him. He sort of throws his cloak at him, and that sort of seems to be some indication that Elisha is supposed to follow. And even in this chapter, there's a little bit of it. It's hard to just quite know exactly what's going on. Three times Elijah says to him, stop. I'm going to go on from here. You stay here. It's like he's trying to put distance between himself and Elisha. And I don't quite know what to do with all that. The main theory that is suggested is that this is Elijah putting Elisha to a series of tests, which might be that actually makes, it's the probably the best sense of it. Three times he's going to tell him to stop, and three times Elisha says, no, I'm going to keep going. And then he comes and he says, all right, now you can ask me for anything you want. It's almost reminiscent of God coming to Solomon in this moment and saying, Solomon, you're the king, ask me for anything you want. And Solomon makes an incredible request. He says, I need a listening or a hearing heart. We translate in English as wisdom. It certainly is that, but it's more than just he wants to be really smart. He knows that if he does not hear from God, he can't govern his people. And so it's almost a moment like that where Elijah's saying to Elisha, you can ask me for anything. And Elisha's response is spectacular. I would want a double portion of the Spirit of God that is on you. Elijah's like, wow, I don't know. I don't know about that one. But you see in the outcome that God responds. It's almost like God saying, that's a good choice. If God ever comes to you and says, ask for anything you want, I mean, make sure forgiveness is first. But second, man, to ask for your Spirit to rest upon me, that I would walk with you and serve you in the ways you called me to, that's a pretty brilliant response. Elijah seems to pass the test. But it's Elisha's view of his relationship with Elijah that is almost as fascinating, because he views him like a father multiple times through this chapter. The language he uses, the way he interacts with him, I mean, specifically he does call him father. There seems to be a hesitance on Elijah's part, but just complete all in on Elisha's part. And I don't quite know what to make of that, other than, I guess if I looked at that, it's like, man, I admire Elisha. We ought not to be hesitant to bring people along with us, but the fact that Elisha is so all in on this is just stunning to me. Now, I do want to just deal real quick with this strange statement he makes there, verse 12, where he calls Elijah the chariots and its horsemen. And I think, I won't deal with it long, but I think essentially what he's saying is kind of what I already referenced, that he views in Elijah just all the hope and the power and the strength that is needed to overcome or to triumph in the day. In other words, if he had a choice between you could have an army or Elijah, the decision on Elisha's part is slam dunk. I want Elijah. What's really interesting is towards the end of Elisha's life, he dies in 2 Kings chapter 13, I think it's around verse 14, and the king who is there as Elisha is dying, he calls Elisha, says, you are the chariots and the horsemen of Israel. In other words, it's like he picks up the mantle and he carries it on with him. All right, for the sake of time, the fourth thing, and then we're going to get to the main point. Yeah, and the same problem as first service. Fourth thing is the aftermath, I'll call it. The responses, because you get four of them. Response number one is Elisha's, which we've already kind of seen. And I love really his heart in this whole situation. In verse 14, his commitment is not to Elijah, even though he recognizes who he is, his strength, his courage, his ministry. You see what he says in verse 14? Where is the Lord? Don't you love that? Not where is Elijah? It's like, where is the Lord? Because if we don't have God, we're in trouble. Just the clarity of that is so amazing. We'll come back to that with the main point in just a moment. The next response is the sons of the prophets. They have a very different response. Their response is not, where is the Lord? Their response is, we need Elijah, like quick. Like, Elisha, yeah, we saw you do the miracle with the Jordan. We get that you have his coat. We've even bowed down to you. Okay, now we've dealt with that. Quick, go find Elijah. And they scour the land looking for him. On the one hand, it seems peculiar, but on the other hand, maybe there are some hints or some connections back to Moses, because when Moses died, no one knew where he was. And they're thinking, maybe Elijah just got picked up and dropped and he's on a mountain somewhere. We can find him. We can bring it back and nothing has to change. We'll just carry on. We don't know exactly what they're thinking, but their thoughts are definitely in that direction. And it seems like when they finally give up, it's not with joy of like, oh, good news. Elijah is in fact with God forevermore. It's more like, oh no, we didn't find him. Third response comes in the city of Jericho. We need to make sure we fit these last two stories together. Jericho, they have a problem. The water is making people sick. It's causing death. And we just get this brief little story, odd little story of Elisha shows up and takes a bowl and takes salt. It's almost like, this may be a bad analogy as I think about it. It's almost like a magic trick in the sense that we focus on the bowl and the salt. And meanwhile, God is saying, it's not about the bowl and the salt. I'm doing something spectacular. Don't focus on the bowl and the salt. Focus on the fact that verse 21 tells us, thus says the Lord. In other words, you could take a bowl and salt and you could have a bad well on your property. And it's like, well, Elisha did this. All you need is a bowl and salt. No, you don't. God does this. This is the work of God. And I'll just say it now. So I think what's going on here is we're seeing that Elisha is now a true prophet of God. That's what we're seeing. So if you go to Deuteronomy 28, what does a true prophet do? He brings blessing and cursing as the spokesman of God. And so what do we need to see from Elisha to know that he has truly replaced Elijah? In other words, that God has raised him up as now the prophet of Israel. We need to see him carry out a ministry of blessing and cursing. And so we see a story of Elisha through the power of God bringing blessing to a city. What do we need to see next? We need to see God bring about cursing. We need to see a prophet of God deliver a message of cursing. What do we have next? He goes now to the city of Bethel. Bethel, by the way, is the center point, the center place of the worship of the golden calf that a previous king had built. Don't read this story and go, this isn't fair. These poor little boys that just like, what a horrible God to do. No, these are young boys. It sounds like a mob of them. 42 of their group end up dead. The implication is it's a much bigger group than that. And they come out of Bethel. In other words, it seems like the picture being painted for us is these are some of the young people, young boys involved in the worship of golden calves when they should have been worshiping God in the city of Bethel. And God is saying, I'm going to bring judgment. Now, the reason he does it, if you go back to Leviticus 26, God says, if you disobey my covenant, turn from me, I will bring judgment. And one of the judgments is actually, I will raise up wild animals to destroy you. Someone said, these are covenant bears. They're not cute. They're not cuddly. They're executing God's judgment and God's justice based on his covenant. And it is serious. It's not a light. And like I said, it's one of those ones that's hard to read and carry the weight of what's going on here. But they taunt Elisha. And let me just see if we can make sure we understand the taunt. Because they say this, go up, you bald head, go up, you bald head. That sounds like they're just teasing a guy because he's bald. I understand what that's like. I wish I could call it bears every once. Maybe not bears, but a small critter. bear in mind that the story back in the start of chapter 2, verse 3, 4, 5, we've told that God is going to remove the English, my translation says his master. He's going to remove his master. I think literally it's actually, he's going to remove his head over him, not his head, but the one who is the leader over him, the head of this ministry. He's going to take that away. And if that's the case and you read through the rest of the chapter, you actually read chapter 2 as one giant chiasm. We've talked about that before, right? Where ideas get repeated and you get... The middle idea is Elisha taken in a whirlwind. But if you work your way back out, you'll see that every idea leading up to it has a parallel leading out of it. And the first idea is God is saying, I'm going to take away the head. And the last idea is these boys teasing him because he's bald. The bald one is gone. Whatever the taunt is, and it's not just a matter of saying he's bald. Like this, that's not what the message is. There's something that they are teasing him about, whether it's because they're saying, hey, your master Elijah had a lot of hair and you don't, and you will never live up to him. I think that's actually what's going on, right? Because what else do they say? Go up, go up. That's the exact description of Elijah ascending into heaven. It's almost like they're coming to him and saying, hey, you think you're fit to be Elijah? You're no Elijah. He had a full head of hair and he ascended to heaven. You ascend to heaven. Like you show, right? They're taunting him as the prophet of God representing God, and God brings judgment because Elisha is a true prophet. And that's how the chapter works. That's how it all fits together. That's why you get these weird stories of a well in Jericho and these boys in Bethel, because God is helping us understand the main point. And the main point is this: succession for God is never a problem. First church I pastored in Sparwood, I remember when I went, there was like 40 people. There's two other men. Well, actually, there's four other men, but one really never came to church, and the other was a retired guy who kind of, he was a retired pastor who kind of had said, well, once you come, I won't go because I don't want to make it difficult. So that left two men, one by the name of Brian, one by the name of Ray. I was 23. I knew virtually nothing. Probably actually less than nothing. But I did know this, that if those two men went, we were in serious trouble. They each one led a small group. One was the treasurer. One did all the maintenance. Like, they between them and their wives, they were that church. I just remember thinking, it's like, wow, if they go, there's nothing left. A year and 2 months after we arrived, they both left on the same week. I'd asked them to stay a year. They kept their word. And I remember at that point just kind of saying, Lord, like, What are you doing? I remember about a month of just feeling like I probably should leave too. Like, let's get out while the going's good, because if they're gone, this whole thing is going down. God took me through that, I think, to teach me. It's like, Don, don't you ever put your hope in men or women. There are some great men and women of faith who I've had the joy of working with, serving with. Many of you sitting in this room, I so admire and appreciate. But if God took out you or me, it's no problem for the Lord. That's the big picture of this chapter. Elijah's gone, Elisha's in his place, and all is well because the Lord is alive and well. Right? His servants might come and go. I love that I can preach this. Like, don't worry, the punchline is not, and now I'm resigning. Like, I love it here. I just bought a new house. Like, so... that we could preach these things at seasons where it's easy to preach them. But when the day comes, when any of us moves on, the Lord is alive and well. You think of how the story begins of this man by the name of Elijah, prophet of the Lord, who knows two things. I serve a living God and I stand in his presence. Those facts never change. They're never even in doubt. There's never a moment of wavering. And we get to the end of the story and he's gone. And what do we know? The Lord is alive and well, and we stand in his presence. Nothing's changed. God carries on. And he raises up people to serve, amazing people. And when they go, he carries on. Most of you have probably had someone like that in your life, someone that you looked to and appreciated, and you thought, oh man, when they're gone, it's going to be so hard. And there probably are hard parts to it. But the point we need to remember and learn and keep our eyes fixed on is when the Lord takes those people out of our lives, he's alive and well, and we stand in his presence. In a few moments, the service will be done, and you will stand up, and you will be standing in his presence, and he's alive and well. And it's not about this building. It's not like this is the place where you stand in his presence. No, you'll walk out the door. You'll be in the parking lot. The Lord is alive, and you're walking in his presence, and tomorrow you will wake up, and the Lord will be alive, and you will be standing in his presence. And those facts will never change. And 2 Kings 2 makes sure we won't ever forget it.